You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 107.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You've reached another Local Maximum. We have a very Local Maximum today. I'd say this interview is peak Local Maximum, but that would be a contradiction in terms, wouldn't it? It's another Bayesian episode, but this time I'm going to kind of really push on it and challenge my mental model of probability by talking to an economist about the ideas put forth in Ludwig von Mises' 1949 treatise, Human Action. Now, as you know, a lot has happened since 1949, but there are a lot of ideas here that are very relevant and that I need to contend with, as I've been basically preaching the gospel of Bayesian inference for the last however many years. So first, let me backtrack a little bit and tell you about how I got so into Bayesian inference in the first place. I was in grad school at NYU, and we're going to actually talk about this in the show, and this is even before I took the machine learning class in the computer science department. I was taking data mining in the business school, of all places, and guess what? I was pretty good in that class. It revolved around, you might have guessed it, you know, solving practical problems for businesses using machine learning techniques, data science techniques. So I started thinking more deeply into what we were doing. I was asking a lot of questions, you know, how do we know that a certain technique will work? Or at least how can we tell what strategy is reasonable, like, you know, which has the most chance for success? And I remember boiling it down to a very simple problem. I always use some kind of junk food or dessert in my examples for some reason. I've been doing this for many years. I don't know exactly why. But as the scorching hot summer of 2010 came around, and that was a hot one, so it was 2011, I started thinking about ice cream. And I imagined that I owned an ice cream shop in the East Village where I lived at the time. And say I had it for many years. And over those years, I collected lots and lots of data on which types of ice cream people would buy, whether it's, you know, vanilla or chocolate or cookies and cream. That's really the best, cookies and cream. I mean, come on. And also assuming that the preferences don't change much over time. Let's say I had a very good idea of what percentage of people in that neighborhood want each flavor. I can just say that's what, you know, East Villagers want, or at least the East Villagers that like walk by the store and want to grab a few scoops. But then I thought, you know, okay, let's say I open up a new store and this ice cream store is going to be in the West Village now. And this neighborhood, if you know New York, has a whole different group of people who might have very different preferences. And so I asked, what, if anything, can I say about the proportion of people who want vanilla, say, at this new store versus the old store? Can I say it's going to be the same as the old store, or can I literally say nothing about it? Is there nothing that I can say? It's a totally new problem. And I realized that the probability and statistics theory that I had internalized previously didn't really have anything useful to say about this situation. And that's a big problem. That's a shame, because these are actually equivalent to the situations we run into all the time in our day-to-day decisions. You know, essentially, one of the things I say is talking about an analogy. Is the two stores, is it a good analogy or a bad analogy? You know, we don't run a fully controlled and repeatable scientific experiment for every little inference and hunch that we want to make in life, you know, because those repeatable scientific experiments, it's the most expensive way to reach a conclusion. It's a very valid way. It's a good way if you really want to test something, if you have the resources. But for most of our decisions, we don't have that. We just have little clues here and there. And so Bayesian inference provided both the key to unlocking problems like the ice cream store problem, and fortunately, it also happened to be the foundation in understanding how large-scale data science and machine learning works. So that's great news. And so also these ideas really help untangle the problems and get to the root of the issue. So for example, the ice cream store problem can be boiled down to do I expect the customers in the new store to behave like the customers in the old store, and to what degree? And for example, you know, a Bayesian hierarchical model can help someone use data to quantify this effect and to try to make a good estimate of what that effect is. I talked about these models in episode 98 with Alex and Dora, and they're often used to model elections sometimes. So fast forward to 10 years later, and I've successfully used this way of thinking to solve a lot of problems in engineering and in business. Great. But as I start to teach this more and more, I realize that the philosophical and meaningful underpinnings of probability and belief are kind of shaky and continually need to be explored and refined. So probabilistic models and inferences are fraught with danger. When they're done right, you get magical products. You get extreme intelligence, almost superpowers that most people don't have. It's competitive advantage. And those superpowers can include, I don't know if we can create a human brain, but we've been able to model things like speech and sight to a pretty strong degree, which gives a lot of like practical applications, yields a lot of practical applications. But that's when these are done right. But when probabilistic models and machine learning ones mismanaged with bad assumptions and bad ideas, it can literally, you know, sink a company. And let's not even get started with the government and political use of statistics. So in the interest of helping us wield this superpower correctly today, we are going to talk about the interpretation of probabilistic statements. I have a lot of uncertainties going into this conversation, as is only logical, given that the conversation is partially about uncertainty. For example, you know, was Mises actually a frequentist, even though it seems like his theory rests upon individual belief, which seems more Bayesian, although, you know, when he was writing, it was really before the frequentist Bayesian wars in academia, which is now kind of behind us. So, again, another big question that I have is, why did he say that subjective probabilities were meaningless, even though we clearly act on them? And then the third question that I had was, you know, finally, what could contending with these ideas mean for my particular approach to problem solving? So we're not going to answer all these questions today because the rabbit hole goes very deep. But we're going to jump into the deep end here, and we're going to make some serious progress. In Bayesian terms, my posterior beliefs will have lower entropy than my prior beliefs going into the conversation. My next guest is the host of the Bob Murphy Show and also the co-host of the Contra Krugman Economics Podcast, one of the best, in my opinion. He holds a PhD in economics from NYU, and he's written on a wide range of relevant social and political topics, including Austrian economics and, of course, the works of Ludwig von Mises. Bob Murphy, you've reached the local maximum. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
And thanks for coming on to talk about stuff that you wrote 10 years ago and going back into that. I really appreciate it.
Sure thing.
So we're going to talk about the interpretation of probability today. It's a crucial topic for my work in data science and machine learning, but a lot of the techniques that I talk about were just not possible decades ago. So I want to get a sense of how these ideas developed over time. And I know that this is, you know, just a piece of the, just a part of a book you read on Mises' Human Action many years ago. But maybe before we start, you can kind of tell the audience about, more of the work that you're doing nowadays. Like, you put out so much articles and content on so many different topics that what do you see as your main line of inquiry these days in 2020?
Well, I appreciate that. Probably it's fair to say that the single thread that goes through most of what I do professionally is that I try to explain economic issues to the layperson. So, you know, a lot of times people email me or come up to me at a conference or something and say, hey, you know, I really appreciate that you take really complicated stuff and you make it in a way I can understand, but it's clear you're not dumbing it down. So the specific things that I've covered for many years, I was really hip deep in the economics of climate change. So like, looking at the so-called social cost of carbon and how do people come up with those estimates and why you need to be careful. And people saying, oh yeah, carbon tax is an obvious, no-brainer solution to this problem. And, just pointing out, well, no, actually there's lots of steps along the way, any one of which could go wrong. Certainly I write a lot about the Federal Reserve and the banking system and how that contributes to the boom-bust cycle, using the theory that was developed by Ludwig von Mises, who we're going to be talking about in a minute here. And then I guess more recently I started my own podcast, The Bob Murphy Show, and that's where I was able to interview people but also talk about other things too. And so I'm a Christian and I like talking to people about the fact that I used to be an atheist, and so I like explaining how I remember when I was an atheist, I thought this stuff was completely irrational and illogical, but actually now that I'm a Christian, let me show you. And so with a lot of this stuff, it's, I guess now to update what I'm saying, it's more, I want people to just think more clearly about certain issues, and I'm not even trying to change people's minds so much, but usually just show, hey, look, if you're thinking about it a certain way, maybe there's this other framework or there's considerations you haven't considered before. So just make sure you're keeping account of this stuff too.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I appreciate when I listen to you and when I read some of your work, is that I actually feel like I'm getting an honest assessment of the facts on both sides, rather than, just someone spiking the football, which is like 90% of opinion writing out there. And I also appreciate that you did an episode on a mathematical topic on Gödel's incompleteness theorem, which I find it so hard to do. I try every few months to do a mathematical show, and I'm going to continue to do it, but it's very hard to do it in the audio format. And I appreciate anyone who gives that a shot as well.
Oh yeah. I mean, I appreciate that. It's funny because that was one where I was so I started my podcast and I was worried, you start a new podcast and you're concerned, like, are people going to listen to two episodes and say, oh, this is terrible and it's going to be a public embarrassment. In the beginning I was just playing it safe and doing the obvious stuff, like interviewing Tom Woods and other libertarian free market people that everyone would be expecting. But yeah, at some point I said, you know what, this is my podcast and I really want to explain to people Gödel's theorem, and because it's really cool and I think I know a way to explain it that, people can get it. There was a really good reaction to that. A lot of people were people who are mathematically trained saying, hey, you did a pretty good job there. That was pretty accurate. And other people just, oh yeah, I never understood that. Cause that was the thing on that one, is I had read, obviously it's very famous and in philosophy of mind and computer science. And so people throw that result around a lot. And yet the secondhand accounts would often, in my mind, they were like internally contradictory, or not internally, but contradictory across different accounts. And so, finally, I think I was in grad school and I was in the library at NYU and I found this great math book that really like walked through the actual proof and showed how it worked. And then when I finally, saw it, I was like, oh, okay, this is great.
Yeah. Would that be the Bopes Library at NYU?
Yes.
I spent quite a bit of time in there as well. Probably no. I was in grad school there in 2009 to 2011, but in the in the computer science department. I don't know when you were there, but
I was
probably
there from 98 to 03.
Okay. So years before, about a decade before, I found a lot of really great books in that library that maybe weren't taught in the courses, but that I got a lot out of just from perusing that library. So. I'm sure that's true of most college libraries, but a lot of nooks and crannies in that one. All right, so let's get into the main topic. The economist Ludwig von Mises wrote about probability in his text Human Action, and this came out in the 1940s, I believe it was 49. Mm-hmm. And so you wrote the definitive study guide to that, I think it's fair to say. So let's start here. Why was Mises so interested in probability at this time, and what was he trying to bring to the economics profession that hadn't been there previously?
Well, so to understand, first of all, just for your listeners, it's an odd title. Like, why is it called Human Action? So let me just take a moment on that. So this is a treatise on economics. Mises was, an economist, I would argue the greatest economist of the 20th century. And so the way he viewed the, how can I put this? So as people, as you know, social scientists began noting the patterns in market phenomena, you know, over the centuries, and then, you know, developing what we would now look back and say, ah, yes, the early stages of economics, Mises realized that eventually what happened is they narrowed it down to say, look, this isn't biology, it's not chemistry, it's not physics, it's not math, it's not history. What is this? And what it was he thought the rigorous logical study of purposive behavior, right? So when people use means to achieve an end. And so, and he summarized that by saying human action, right? And so that's why that's the title of his treatise. And so he's saying what he called praxeology was the logical science of action. And then a specific subset of that, when you assume that there's private property in the use of money, is what he called catalactics. Okay.
How is economics usually defined? And I hate to use the term like usually, but in the, I don't know, if you go to an economic econ 101 course in a college, they usually don't define it as the study of, you know, human action. They usually say something else, right?
Yeah, well, for one thing, a lot of times they don't bother to define it. You know what I mean? To them, that's like, oh, we're not doing philosophy here. You know, let's roll up our sleeves and, you know, and get into the economics. Come on, we all know what we're doing. We're studying how the economy works, and we want to, you know, reduce unemployment. That, you know, we want to help poor people. So I think there's that element. When I was writing my book Choice, which was not like literally a study guide, but more of a distillation of the main points of human action. So, you know, Choice is like a 350 so page book, whereas Human Action's, I think, 900 plus, something like that. That's what I did in the opening chapter, as I was trying to explain that. And I went and surveyed a bunch of economic either textbooks or like books for the lay person written by economists, a kind of, you know, introduction to how economists think. And yeah, some of them, I mean, like graduate level texts, it was funny, like the stuff that I used at NYU when I was a grad student, I mean, they just jump right into, okay, here's the production function of the economy, and there's F, you know, with K and L as the inputs, and they just jump right into it. They don't bother explaining, here's what we're doing in this course of study. Whereas the more introductory, lower level ones, they'll often say stuff like, economics is the study of how society uses scarce resources to achieve competing ends, or something like that, or the determination of which goods should be produced and how they should be allocated. You know, sometimes you'll see language like that. The ones that I think are better and closer to the Misesian approach will say something like, economics is the study of rational choice, or something like that.
Okay, so that's similar, I guess. But I could see the connection there, though. Definitely, like, hey, we're making all this stuff, we're accumulating stuff, using stuff, doing stuff. I mean, it all boils down to action and choices, and how that works on an individual level, and how that works on a group level.
Right, and so, yeah, I mean, there the difference. So, and that's why too, in case your listeners have noticed this, it leads to what's called economic imperialism, by which they mean economists, instead of staying in their lane and just talking about inflation and the business cycle and, you know, economic growth, will then start talking about the dating market, you know, just even that phrase, the dating market, you know, like that's an economic type of use, or, you know, just going into other disciplines like sociology or criminology, like the economic analysis of crime. And you might, you know, there's famous analyses like, oh, well, you know, criminals get a certain amount of utility and with police enforcement, and there's a probability of being arrested and put in prison and da, 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 da. And so what's the optimal punishment for crime? And, you know, that, or law and economics. So, yeah, there's a lot of things where tools and techniques that were originally developed to explain a consumer with a limited budget seeing an array of prices and having preferences and figuring out, how do I spend my money to maximize utility in the marketplace? Like that framework, what if instead I want to, you know, analyze a politician trying to decide what should my platform be to maximize my votes in the next election? And that's what's called public choice theory, right? Or, you know, the economic analysis of crime doesn't assume criminals are crazy nut jobs just going around murdering people and robbing banks because, you know, they have these impulses and they can't control. No, it's a very rational, well, the criminal engages in a cost-benefit analysis and, you know, that kind of stuff. So, but whether or not one endorses, and some of those things give me the creeps, to be honest with you, some of those, especially like people looking at the so-called dating market as economists. That just gives me the creeps. But in any event, where that comes from is this idea that really what economists, you know, the techniques economists use to explain consumer behavior or to explain the owner of a firm and how he makes decisions based on, you know, the technology he has at his disposal and the input and output prices, that those techniques are applicable beyond just the narrow sphere of what we commonly consider economic decisions, you know, and so that's the idea. And that's why Mises thought the proper scope for what he was doing was not just a book on economics. Like, he didn't just call his book the Economy or something. He called it Human Right. Action, because he realized that's actually the foundation. And then once he lays the foundation, now he's going to home in on, you know, specific assumptions about, let's say, you know, purposive behavior in the context of a society with private property and the use of money. And that's what we mean by, you know, a market economy.
Yeah. So he tackles the idea of probability pretty early on in the book. It was like, it's chapter mm-hmm. six. Your study guide corresponds to the chapters in the book, right? I'm sorry, I didn't read Human Action. I only read parts of your study guide.
Yeah, I think that's, I'm pretty sure that's correct. And yes, yeah. It's page 107 is where he starts in the Scholar's Edition. But since, like I say, the Human Action's a really big book, that's still relatively early, even though some people might say, geez, he doesn't get around to it until page 107.
Okay, yeah. So what was his interest in this? Yeah. I should also point out his brother was a mm-hmm. Professor in probability theory in Harvard. Yep. So
yeah, this is impressive. I just realized I almost went 14 minutes without answering the question you asked me.
That's right. We got into some interesting stuff.
Where I meant to go with this originally when I was giving you that long-winded answer was to say that, you know, that apparently Murray Rothbard, who's a big fan of Mises, when he tells the story that when he heard Mises was coming out with a new book, you know, namely Human Action, and Rothbard said, "What's it about?" And the person said, "Everything." Right. So you know, this book really does. I mean, Mises gets into all kinds of stuff, including like, oh, how it was that Rome fell because of the price controls. You know, that's really, you know, that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? So he really just speaks about all kinds of stuff in this book. And so, yeah, as you say, Mises' brother, Richard, you know, is an accomplished, you know, published mathematician and did work on this. And so here, let me be transparent with you. I'm not an expert on like Richard von Mises' thought and exactly how, you know, his views differ from Mises, but I have heard people, you know, giving lectures on this topic say that, yeah, even though Mises, you know, didn't come right out and say my brother's wrong on this, that, you know, that's partly who he was rebelling against here.
Interesting. Yeah, I always thought he was like using his brother's work. Now you're saying that he's kind of saying it's kind of a little sibling rivalry going on there.
I mean, I'm not trying to be evasive, but I think it's actually kind of really nuanced. Like Mises borrowed some of it. Like Mises certainly benefited from having read his brother's work, but he disagreed on some points. But again, okay. I don't want to say, because Richard said this and then Ludwig said that. Like, I don't know them well enough, but I do know.
Yeah, certainly, I don't either. I'm just,
Mises was aware of his brother's work and that certainly influenced it. But I have definitely heard, you know, experts on this say that Mises did differ from his brother on some of these points. But in any event, so it's, you know, it, as you would say, like, well, gee, why is this stuff on probability in here? It's just because Mises, I mean, he's given like the whole philosophical underpinning of how do we, you know, like what's the logical, status of economics, you know, what's the epistemological foundation of economics per se. And partly he's doing that because nowadays some of it might seem quaint and like, what are you wasting all your time doing? It's just, you know, tell me how the business cycle functions or operates. What's going on here? It's partly because Mises is coming out of a tradition where there was like logical positivism. And then also there were Marxists who would say things like, oh yeah, there's, you know, there's bourgeois economics, but that, you know, rests on faulty axioms, and if you have the proper, you know, understanding of things, you'll see that the theorems of David Ricardo and such are nonsense. And so Mises had to really, you know, first of all, just establish the philosophical underpinnings of what he was doing, because otherwise somebody could just appeal to polylogism and say, oh, well, there's multiple logics, and yeah, your theories, you economists are true in your logic, but not according to our superior, you know what I mean? So that's partly why Mises has to go through all this stuff that might look to an outsider like it's philosophy and not economics. And so it's not surprising that in that context, part of what he talks about is the nature of probability. Because, and so, you know, part of what he's doing here is he's trying to establish, and through his discussion, he typically couches it in terms of the business person. And, you know, and so like what types of probability or you know, these classifications that, you know, I guess you and I are going to talk about here in a minute, Max, that, you know, if a business person knows that a certain percentage of his produce will rot in the warehouse, you know, what how does that affect his behavior and so forth? Like, is that gambling and, you know, stuff like that? And what does it mean when you take out insurance, stuff like that? So that's
right.
That's part of the connection and why he goes through the trouble of laying this stuff out, is because it does overlap and have implications for how an economist is going to deal with stereotypically economic issues.
Yeah, I find that most of the difficult decisions in business and life are not like, oh, I'm going to invest this amount and then this is going to be my rate of return. It's no, like, I'm going to do this thing and then that changes the probabilities of what might happen. But I still don't know what my risk reward and trade-off should be. And I'm making this decision because I think, hey, it's probably going to put me in a better position where a better outcome is more likely.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that I should probably mention that just occurred to me, another reason for all of this and the detail he goes into on this stuff is that originally economic theory, certainly in the 1800s and early 1900s, was developed primarily in the context of certainty. You know, so in other words, the extent that you would try to mathematically model something, or not even mathematically, but like formally model something, you know, an economy, have like a little simple toy economy with, right, oh, there's, you know, there's a wheat sector and there's a, you know, or let's say a corn sector, and then there's traded goods and blah, 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 those sorts of things. Usually everything was pinned down in definite, you know, deterministic in the model. And that's how you'd get certain results, like, you know, to show
them. Well, the farmer knows that if they plant crop A instead of crop B, they know they'll make more money. So obviously they'll go to crop A.
Yeah. Or just to show the benefits of you know, free trade internationally and things like that with so-called comparative advantage. Those demonstrations are all using, you know, they're deterministic. There's no uncertainty. So lots of the standard results in economic science or theory were done in a context of certainty. But then in the 20th century, at some point, certainly the 40s and the 50s, economists started taking more seriously the issues of uncertainty and how do we deal with that. And often what would happen, particularly among those economists who were more mathematically fluent and who liked to express their economic theories in the language of formal math, and Mises wasn't one of them, by the way, that he had a lot of problems with that enterprise. But what they would often do is just, it was basically the same kind of framework. It's just they would introduce random variables. And so, yeah, and the agent, instead of knowing exactly what the market price was going to be next year and then optimizing to maximize his utility function, instead would say, okay, well, there's going to be a distribution of possible prices, but I know what, you know, the mean and standard deviation and higher moments, blah, 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 the distribution are. And so then I'll optimize the expectation of my, you know, redefined utility function that takes into account uncertainty, that, you know, that kind of stuff.
And so what's wrong with that?
Well, I mean, there's lots of things we could get into, but I think this isn't just Mises, but the general Austrian concern with that is you've just kind of pushed the problem back one step. So it's like, yeah, you're admitting people aren't omniscient, but you do assume that they perfectly know the structure of the world. And, you know, so yeah, they know exactly every outcome that might happen and they have the correct probabilities to assign to it. So it's still like an equilibrium framework. There's no genuine surprise or learning going on in those models. It's just,
I see.
So in other words, it's not really grappling with the problem of, in the real world, people aren't like the things in the, you know, these people in the models that know what's going on with certainty.
Gotcha. Okay, so I talk a lot about this on this show about the objective view of probability, or the frequentist view, and subjective probability, which is sort of a degree of belief in how likely I think a certain event is going to happen. And I sort of deal day to day in subjective probability, which is why I kind of feel the need to contend with what Mises had to say about it. But would you say this corresponds to what Mises called class probability and case probability?
It's similar. So let me, I'll just briefly lay it out. Like if I were just teaching this to a, you know, an undergrad class or, well,
yeah,
probably even in a graduate level class, cause this gets pretty deep, but
go for it.
It's similar, but I don't think he's like making the distinction and along the same fault line, as it were. So yeah, when Mises discusses this, he's got class probability versus what he calls case probability. And for class probability, he says, you know, there's some events where, or you know, there's a whole class of phenomena, and we think we know certain facts about the whole class. So for example, for a certain city over the period of a year, we're pretty sure we know how many people are going to die, you know, of that. We just don't know which one. So all we can say about any individual person in the city is they are a member of this broader class, and we think we have some knowledge about the behavior of the class as a whole. Okay.
So, would he also apply that to like a dice roll where it's like, you know, hey, I know it's like, you know, 1/6 for each side. I just don't know how much any particular roll of the dice, we can't predict what it's going to be, but we do know the overall structure of, you know, or any casino game for that matter.
Yeah, I think he would say that. Yes. And then he said, in contrast, and so the way you remember that, of course, is class probability, meaning we know information about the whole class. And then case probability, gotcha, is more like about a unique historical case. And he's saying here, you know, you can have subjective estimates as to, you know, what's going to happen, but really this is a non-repeatable, unique historical event. And so the classic example he uses on this one is a presidential election. And so here he says, so, you know, with the class probability, just to back up. So again, you know, a life insurance company can say, oh, there's a million people and we think such and such are probably going to die. And so if we want to charge the actuarially fair premium plus maybe a little margin for our, you know, overhead and whatever, this is the number we'd have to charge. And as long as we sell enough such policies, then we're not gambling. We're just, you know, we're covered. Whereas he's saying if he only sold a few policies, then they would be gambling. And so that's the way he handles that. Whereas he's saying somebody, you know, looking at a presidential election who perhaps wants to wager on it, and or somebody who says, oh, I think there's a 60% chance that Roosevelt is going to get reelected, Mises is saying that's really just a metaphor. There's no real scientific precision. There's no real meaning to that statement because it's, you know, like what exactly do you mean by that? That, oh, if we held this presidential election 100 times in a row, then 60 of them, you know what I mean? Like it's not, what does that even mean to say there's a 60% chance Roosevelt's going to be reelected? And you can translate it into statements about, well, how much, you know, I would be willing to pay, put up this many dollars to win 100 if Roosevelt, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
But even there, because that mixes in your risk preferences or your love of gambling per se. And so even two people who had the same, you know, estimates about what was going to happen probabilistically might give different reports as to, you know, what their trade-off would be in terms of how much would you have to put up or would you be willing to put up to win $100. So that's kind of where he gets in. So there he's recoiling against the attempts to use mathematical language in there where he thinks it's giving this sense of precision where really it's not warranted. So yes, like you say, Max, it totally makes sense to say, oh, there's a 1 in 6 chance that if I roll this thing that I assume is a fair die, a 3 will come up. But to say there's only a 1 in 6 chance that Tulsi Gabbard's going to win the Democratic nomination, that doesn't really mean anything.
So I have a little problem with that because, well, let me see how I'm going to put this. Like, it's meaningful for me if I put a number on something. Let's say I want to take a flight. I want to fly to the West Coast. And I know there's like a 1 in billion chance the flight will crash. Then I'll take my chances. I'll fly to the West Coast. But if I thought maybe there was like a 1 in 10 that the flight was going to crash, and this is like a one-off type thing, mm-hmm, then no way I would take that flight. So right. There's sort of, I feel like the number that someone comes up with subjectively is still important. And so I don't know how, like, when he says it has no meaning, I don't know. You see how I'm having trouble putting those two together? Like, it's you make decisions off of it. It's certainly rational to make decisions off of your subjective opinion as to whether a one-off event is going to happen or not. We do it all the time. And yet the number has no meaning. How could those two things both be true?
Let me just try restating it, then maybe we can grapple more with what the difficulty is. So, and by the way, I think I understand what you're getting at. So I'm not saying I fail to see your concern, but let me just try it this way. So
sure.
Again, like to say you roll a die and to say, oh, I think the chance of a 3 coming up is 1 in 6. What does that actually mean? Mises would say, oh, what it means is the set of all possible outcomes is, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We don't know anything about the individual outcomes except that they're a member of that class. We know that one of the numbers has to come up, and so that's what we mean when we say there's a 1 in 6 chance that any particular number is going to come up. And he even goes so far as to say that when people, like in textbooks or whatever, when they define that and they throw in the assumption, assume each outcome is equal probable, he even quibbles with that and says, no, that's redundant, or that per se doesn't make any sense. Or not that it doesn't make sense, but he says it's circular argument. He's saying, in other words, there, when you're trying to define what do you mean by to say the probability of this event happening is a 1 in 6, to start your definition of probability by saying assume every outcome has an equal probable outcome, you get what I'm saying? Or Mises is saying, wait a minute, you're using the notion of probability to define probability. That's a circular argument. So that's that's, I don't know if that helps a little bit to see where he's coming from when he's talking about what does that mean. So like,
you can't use probability to define probability. You can't use likelihood or chances or any other word. You almost have to start somewhere. It's almost like, hey, you have two possible outcomes or multiple possible outcomes, and you're almost trying to find the relative likelihood. But I just use likelihood to define it.
So, as far as the plane thing, Mises would certainly, if you said, taking the plane from here to L.A. is safer than driving a car. And someone said, what do you mean? And you say, oh, well, because considering the whole class of airplane flights, especially if we measure it by passenger mile traveled or something, and then the number of deaths, and all I really know is that, my flight is going to be one member of that whole class. There, that's the meaningful sense in which I can say the probability of me dying in the plane crash for this given trip of a given distance is less than if I drove in a car. And that's certainly true, and that's fine. Mises wouldn't have a problem with that sort of statement, but again, things that are, when you start getting more specific about it, I wouldn't go on a date with that guy with that tattoo and whatever, he just gives me the willies. I bet you there's anywhere from a 70 to 80% chance that guy's going to attack me. Strictly speaking, Mises, that, what does that mean? You're making those numbers up. You can't translate that. Whereas with the die roll, I can tell you exactly how I'm coming up with that number and what that really, quote, means. Whereas to say, oh, gee, I think there's anywhere from around a 70 to 80% chance that guy's going to attack me if I hang out with him for the next 2 hours. I think Mises would say, strictly speaking, that's metaphorical. That doesn't even mean anything. There's no way you can translate that into something else. Because again, if you tried to, if you try to do it mechanically, you might say, oh, well, what I mean is over a million repeated trials, my best, and it's like, well, you're not going to, what does that even mean?
This is something that I'm going to have to, talk about through multiple shows, because there's a lot to wrap my head around on this one. But I do feel like subjective probability is maybe, it's meaningful in that's what a person is basing their decisions off of, And by the way, coming up with the subjective probabilities, coming up with those rankings of how likely something is, there's more competent ways to do it. There's less competent ways to do it. Someone could just be making up the numbers, and then someone could be using Bayes' theorem and doing a very good job at coming up with the numbers, right? Mm-hmm. There definitely has to be a way of saying, hey, the relative likelihood, whether I'm saying, hey, there's an 87.2% chance that so-and-so is going to win the election. I mean, that's kind of, that's almost too specific. Or whether you just break it out into very good chance, good chance, whether you kind of give a qualitative value. I feel like a predictor can be kind of calibrated over time to sort of make sure that, you know, you're giving, you know, some people are much better at giving subjective probabilities than others. And then you can almost say that objectively, because then you kind of aggregate all of them together. But it's I don't know if you have any comment on that, on where I'm trying to go here.
Let me. So again, I mean, this whole, I have it in front of me here. I'm just skimming it to see. So yeah, to be clear, I mean, Mises is not denying that, you know, when the future is open-ended and uncertain, that, people have different expectations, if you want to use that word, and that influences
right.
their current decisions.
Right,
and that,
right.
You know, if something seems riskier or more dangerous, they might avoid it and whatever. But so what he's grappling, though, with is he's trying to explain that in a logically satisfactory way. And I think the only thing he's resisting is the understandable temptation to use the the mathematical language of probability that does make sense when it comes to what he calls class probability, and then to apply it in his mind inappropriately to case probability. So again, it's that's really what he, you know what I mean? So in other words, he's just trying to say, yeah, in the real world, and we as economists have to grapple with the fact that the future's open-ended and uncertain, and people, when they act, need to grapple with that, but let's not just impose this framework that really doesn't make sense in that setting and only really makes sense in a very specialized set of circumstances.
Okay, so what would be a good example of someone saying, like, using using rules from class probability in the wrong way, or in the way I would put it, like they use a frequentist objective probability, and then they apply it in the subjective case, and they do it, and it's not appropriate.
Let's try it like this. So it's difficult if you see somebody, one person betting that a certain candidate's going to win and someone else not betting that candidate's going to win.
Sure.
You might be tempted to say, oh, that first guy assigns a higher subjective probability to that person winning than the other guy did. But strictly
right.
speaking, you can't conclude that. It could be the first guy just enjoys gambling more.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So there's things like that where, again, it's...
Or the risk aversion. Different risk aversion.
Right.
Unpredicted. I lost $5 because I put $5 on Biden winning New Hampshire, because I saw that if I won, I would get $250. If he won, I'd get $250. So I thought, why not take the chance?
Right. you couldn't just observe people's actions and then back out, you know, and what their internal subjective probabilities must actually be. Because, again, there's always another element involved, and it's, you know, this is a little bit loose, but like the measuring rod you think you're using is itself, you know, changeable or malleable. So I guess that's one way of getting at the issue. And so it's not that Mises has this alternative framework to give you that's, you know, just as precise as assuming, you know, like using the Bayes approach. It'd be his whole point, though, is, you know, that's a false sense of precision, if you get
okay.
what I'm saying. So that, I, you know what I mean? Like, I think I get what you're saying. Like, oh, okay, so he's saying this is right. Well, what does he do? And it's more like he's just trying to clarify and say, beware of just taking over this apparatus that, strictly speaking, really only makes sense in a narrow field of activity, and then applying it over here where it really doesn't make sense.
I think I understand it. Although I probably don't understand it enough to explain it on my own, and so that's one of the things that I'm going to probably struggle with for several shows going forward. But I do think I'm starting to get it. There's a lot of stuff in terms of, like, you know, Bayesian inference, the idea that we start with a belief distribution over several different hypotheses, mm-hmm. and then we use this data to update those beliefs. Something I use all the time to solve real problems, I have to say, wasn't a popular view of statistical inference in the 1940s. But I wonder what he would say about some of the applications that have come up, you know, since he wrote the book. You know, some of the things that I've read about, for example, are insurance companies in the 50s and 60s started saying, you know, we actually can insure one-off events or events that against events that have never occurred before. We as a company can competently come up with a probability that that event will occur. And then of course, you know, the last 10, 20, 30 years applied to machine learning and all of these applications that we mm-hmm. we have online, whether it's image recognition, audio recognition, or sentiment analysis, all that stuff is solved on, on a kind of Bayesian engine. So spam detection, one of the earliest ones on email, probably written in the 80s, would be a very good example. So obviously, you know, it would be hard for Mises to talk about that in 1949. And I always need to put like a caveat when we speculate what someone would have said. You know, you don't know what someone would have said, but do you have any thoughts on like how he would have reacted to some of those developments?
Okay, sure. Great question. So I don't remember him ever talking about what we would think of as like, you know, a Bayesian approach to uncertainty. I asked David Gordon too, who's an expert on Mises' thought, and he said he couldn't recall Mises ever talking about that. And like you say, like in terms of its use among economists, at least, yeah, it wasn't really, my understanding is it wasn't until like the 50s at least where that really took off. And so he wouldn't have had a chance. My guess though is that Mises would have been very skeptical of it. So the stuff that we can say, I'll give you an example. So as he's discussing these issues in human action, you know, he would say, okay, let's say there's people running a lottery and, you know, they sell a certain number of tickets, and as long as, you know, what the proceeds they're paying are just, you know, the sum of the revenue from the ticket sale, the people running the lottery are not gambling. And he said, however, if they didn't sell some of the tickets, he's saying then they are, with respect to those tickets, just like the gamblers are, you know, the people who are buying the tickets. So in other words, it's almost like they themselves are buying those tickets. You know, if you think through that, you know, it works out, the math works out. Like, oh yeah, like, you know, if the pot's $1,000, like, you know, the winner, whoever gets the winning ticket is going to get $1,000 cash prize, and you're selling 1,000 tickets for $1 a piece, but they only sell 850 of them. Well, you know, then it's as if the people running the thing themselves bought 150 tickets, because, you know, there's a, if the winning ticket's one of theirs, then they obviously make a bunch of money. But if they, you know, if somebody, one of those 850 people get it, then they're out $150, which is exactly the position of somebody who bought 150 tickets. So, you know, there's that sort of element. And then he, you know, generalizes to say, like with life insurance companies or, you know, property and casualty insurance or whatever, that if you sell enough that you've, you know, that there's a sense in which you're covering the whole class. And even there, he's admitting in practice, none of this stuff is actually exact. For one thing, just because you know how many people died in a certain city over the last, you know, for each of the last 50 years, that actually doesn't tell you how many people are going to die this next year. You know, there could be an earthquake, there could be an asteroid, you know what I mean? So even there, nothing is actually really the class, but he's just saying we assume we know all the relevant facts for the class as a whole in certain cases.
I mean,
cases.
The way I say it, to translate into my language, I say, like, all probability is subjective. It's just mm-hmm. some of it is, you feel like you have so much information, you could treat it as mm-hmm. as solid.
Yeah. So even there, like, even with all the caveats, he says, so as long as they, you know, issue enough policies that they reasonably are covered, then that's not gambling. But he said if they only sold a few policies, then that would be, that wouldn't be insurance. That would be, or they wouldn't be just running a regular business. They would be gambling. Just like with the casino, you know, you need a lot of people to be playing for it to just be a business. If only a few people come in, then the casino's gambling too. You know,
right.
I mean, they have better odds, but they're still gambling. They're, you know, they're playing a game where the advantage is in their favor, but still, you know, like the only reason you can, quote, be safe as the casino owner is if you have lots of people playing for, you know, hours at a time. So I think to, you know, circle back to what you were saying, Max, I'm guessing that, yeah, if Lloyd's of London or something is tech, you know, insuring Liberace's fingers or whatever, you know, I've heard cases of things
right.
that Mises would probably just say that was an informed, you know, speculative investment or something. You know, in other words, that he's not saying it's a foolish thing for them to do. They have experts and they make judgment calls. And I think, you know, he might say it's a wager. He might not call it gambling. And so the distinction there being like seasoned experts who go and bet money on horses, you know, they're placing a wager or they're betting. Mises reserves that term gambling, meaning when it's pure luck, you know, someone playing roulette or something, that's gambling. Whereas right. somebody well, betting on a heavyweight fight, that's betting or laying a wager, I think is the terminology he would use there.
Right. I could see like a firm doing many one-offs where each one is completely unique and they have like analysts look at each one, but maybe they're betting on hundreds or thousands of them. And so it's still hard to call that a class because each one is so unique, but.
Right. So, yeah. I think Mises would say, you know, in other words, people say, oh, we're not just betting on the outcome of the presidential election. We have wagers on all the congressional races and blah, blah, blah. And we're also betting on all the football games. And so, from the perspective of the person who believes in subjective probability theory, they would say, as long as our estimates of the actual probabilities aren't too far off, the more of these cases that we throw in, it's like we have a whole class. And so, yeah, it's not gambling. You know, it's a safe business move, especially if we only do it when we think, you know, the prices in the market are different from what the subjective probabilities imply is the, quote, fair price. But yeah, I think Mises would recoil from that and just say, no, those are many back-to-back instances of you either gambling or wagering, depending on, you know, the nature of the specific thing. And so, yeah, you can't say, oh, the thing that ties this all together is they're all events that have a, you know, 1 in 10 chance of happening. Since Mises thinks, no, for any given case, when you say there's a 1 in 10 chance of that happening, that's nonsense language. You don't render it sensible by putting it into a category of other such equal probable events, I think is how he would handle it.
Yeah. Oh, sorry for jumping around, but I just thought of a really good example for the presidential election one, because I was at the Soho Forum, which I understand you're coming and doing a debate there in a few months. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's April 20th.
Okay. So I was there, I don't remember how long ago. It was a few months ago, and they were debating. It was a very specific, like, oh, should the Libertarian Party nominate someone like Gary Johnson or not? Should they nominate someone who's more, let's say, like ideologically pure? Mm-hmm. And right. So on the no, we shouldn't side was Dave Smith, who you've had on your show, right?
Oh, yeah.
And the head of the Libertarian Party was on, or the chairman was on the yes side. And one of the arguments that he made, which lost him my vote essentially as the voter, was when he was like, oh, well, you know, Gary Johnson got this many votes. And then look, in 1988, Ron Paul got fewer votes than that. So look, it didn't work. And that was, you know, That was the argument that just made me groan, and then I was like, okay, I'm not. Sometimes one bad argument for me kind of sours it.
Right.
I hate to say it, but that just did not work for me.
Yeah, and it's interesting you say it. So Mises also, in this very discussion of case probability, then at the end of the section transitions into our historical understanding of events that have already occurred, and so he's saying, you know, when people argue about, like, you know, why did Napoleon win this campaign, or why did this happen, or how come the communists took over, or whatever, that there's a sense, you know, when you're trying to assign importance to the different factors, you know, some people might be more expert and have better judgment than others, but ultimately, you know, it's hard to really say, and you certainly can't be precise about it or rigorous about it, you know, just as it really doesn't make sense to say, you know, oh, there's a 1 in 6 chance that FDR is going to win. Likewise, to say, oh, you know, the fact that whatever Napoleon's troops had better equipment is, you know, responsible for 60% of his win. And you know what I mean? Like that really, like, what does that mean?
You'll never get a definitive answer there.
I believe it's not merely that Mises is saying, how could you ever know? I think he's going to say, strictly speaking, that's nonsense. Like, history is what it was. And I guess you could say, well, suppose there was an alternative universe where we tweaked one thing 2 days earlier. But then again, that's kind of again like saying, well, what we mean when we say there's a 1 in 6 chance of FDR is suppose we ran this election a million times in a row. And again, it's like, well, what does that even mean? You know, so.
Yeah, yeah. So it's hard to tell what it means. And yet, I see your point. And yet, I'm going to say, well, we all use subjective judgments and probabilities to try to figure out what is going to happen in the future. Maybe, maybe if I stick to my exercising, hopefully I'll get healthier, I'll lose weight or whatever. And so we all kind of have these probabilistic, hey, if I do this, there's going to be X, there's going to be Y outcomes. And if we sort of, I don't see how you could say, well, I can apply this to future things, but I can't apply this to things in the past and say, hey, if I did this thing 10 years ago, then by now something would have been different. And so if you can do that, then it seems like maybe you can apply it to that same line of reasoning to a historical event. But my only caveat would be that it's just you're not going to be able to come up with a very precise estimate. In something like, why did Napoleon's troops do well here and not there, et cetera, et cetera. Like, you can't come up with a very good, but I still think there are things you can say about the past, like, if someone had done this, then that would have happened.
Oh, sure, and I don't think Mises, I mean, I know Mises would agree right with you. You know what I mean? So he's definitely, I think, was a decent historian in his own right. So he's not objecting to that, and Mises has his opinion. You know, he said things like, as I alluded to earlier, like in Mises' opinion, oh, the reason the Roman Empire fell, it wasn't because, you know, to just say, oh, because the barbarian invasions. And Mises, well, the barbarians had been invading for a long time, and they were always repelled before. Why did they succeed this? And Mises thought it was the price controls, that the people fled the cities, and actually many of them in the outskirts were starving, and they welcomed the so-called conquerors coming in because they were starving and, you know, that kind of stuff. So there, yeah, he's making his own theoretical judgment, or he says the reason the Soviets did so well against the Germans was because of Lend-Lease and whatever, and that, you know, without the capitalist engine of the West supplying them, they would have been overrun, you know, that kind of stuff. So again, that's a historical judgment he's rendering. I think all his point is just trying to be rigorous and say, you know, warning his economist colleagues primarily, don't just adopt this framework that does make sense in a very narrow area and just apply it over here where it really doesn't make sense. Maybe a real quick analogy just to try to illustrate this. So it's also common for economists to use what's called utility functions, and you know, like, because they have mathematical models where, oh, the consumer has a utility function where you plug in, you know, the quantity of apples and oranges, and maybe it's, you know, concave and blah, blah, blah. And so, given the budget constraint and the prices, maximize utility. And so then that leads you to believe there's such a thing as utils, and it's a cardinal thing. And Austrians typically say, no, it isn't. And that's not to deny that people in the real world make choices and that they get more utility from one thing than another. It's just saying it's not a cardinal entity. And the analogy I use to illustrate that or motivate that, which I think is intuitive to most people, say, I can say who my best friend is and even like who my second best friend is. Like, so I can rank my friends according to how much friendship I have with them. But if I, you know, to say, oh, by how much percentage does my best friend have more friendship with me than my second best friend, you know, that it's not just that, oh, you could never really know that. It's like, no, that some people would say that's a meaningless question. That doesn't even make sense. That's not so. Likewise, the fact that I can say, oh, gee, I wouldn't go swim with sharks, especially if they had laser beams on their heads, because that's too dangerous or risky. You know, that's not the same thing as saying, oh, you know, I wouldn't wager a certain amount to roll a die and I only get paid off if a 2 comes up because I know the probability of that's only 1 in 6. Like, even though those both involve me shying away from something because of the risk involved or the danger or the potential downside, I think Mises is just saying, be careful. Don't apply the language of mathematical probability to both of them when it really only makes sense in the one case.
Right. Okay. So I think I have one more question on this, which actually I think now that we've had this conversation, I think I could answer on my own of what Mises or might have said, or what, you know, or what this line of reasoning might have said, but maybe you can tell me if I'm right or not. So the question I have written here is, you know, what do you think he would have made of the modern use of Bayesian inference and successfully solving problems, say, in the engineering world? That's kind of the world I live in, and that's sort of, you know, I always present Bayesian inference as an amazing tool to solve problems. I never presented it on this program as, you know, the only way to get at truth, or even you have to have other ways to get at truth before you even get to Bayes' theorem. So that wouldn't even make sense. But it is an incredible tool for solving a lot of problems faced by businesses and by engineers. And my guess is, even if some of the problems that I solve are actually class probabilities, they're just very complicated ones. But even if they're case probabilities, he would have said, you know, have fun coming up with those numbers to, you know, post a number to the likelihood of something happening in order to solve problems, say the likelihood that someone will like a restaurant. That's a lot of what we do here at Foursquare. But, you know, hey, there are a lot of caveats you come up with when you come up with these complicated models of, well, a good example that we do, that I've done, is trying to figure out whether ads are working and whether people are caused to go somewhere by the ad or whether they would have gone anyway. You could try to answer those problems, and we do, and people are willing to pay for attempts to try to answer those problems, but there are always a lot of caveats, and the more complicated the model gets, you know, the more you have to worry and second guess, maybe this answer is not meaningful. I guess, the more variables that come into the equation, the more likely you are to be making a serious error, in my view. Maybe that's getting away from his sort of, it doesn't make sense to say that this friend is a 20% better friend than that friend, but that's...
Okay, that's, yeah, let me try to take a shot at that.
Okay.
So here I was going to be funny and say there's a 90% chance Mises would agree with what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So you see what I did there? So I am pretty sure that he would, at least this would be close to how he would handle it. But again, I can't remember him specifically dealing with this sort of thing, so I'm not sure. But like when it comes to business cycle research, right? So he did a lot of work on that, and he laid out the theory of it. And I think he would say something like, you know, let's say there's people in the stock market, you know, hedge funds or whatever, and maybe they do technical analysis, you know. So, oh, look, there's a head and shoulders pattern. They're looking at stock prices, and they come up, and maybe, you know, they do very well with that analysis. And, you know, they have a higher return on their, you know, customers' money and blah, 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 and so forth. They got all, you know, growing money under management, and it seems like they're pretty successful. And you could see them arguing that, look at this, you know, these techniques, this model that we've built has outperformed all of our peers over the last 10 years. We've hit, you know, we've beaten the market 10 years in running. And so this is the sense that we're going to say, we understand what drives stock prices better than anybody else. And I think Mises would say, you know, that's fine. And certainly people out there in the real world have to make decisions. You have to invest, you know, so somebody's got to own corporate shares of stock, and they can be guided by all sorts of different paradigms. And if they're doing better than I, Ludwig von Mises, would do, that proves they're better investors than I am. And, you know, they're more entrepreneurial and so forth. But it's just, I think he would say something like, they don't actually have the true model. It's not the case, really. The quote true thing driving stock prices is whatever model they're using, that it's possible next year there's a panic and all the stock prices drop to zero or whatever, down to a penny, even though their model, you know what I mean? In other words, it's not literally the case that they can't lose money. They might go bankrupt at any moment, in which case it's, oh wow, their model was working great up until that break point. And, you know, because human action really is not reducible to just a few variables. So I think he would say something like that. And likewise with the stuff you're doing, I don't think he would have a problem with it. I think he would just say what you're doing is market forecasting or something, or consumer forecasting. That's not, you know, like in other words, or not in other words, but for an example, a Halloween shop, certainly they're virtually certain they're going to do a lot more business the week before Halloween than they're going to do the week of July 4th. You know, if what they sell is like Batman costumes and stuff. But is that really like a law of human action in the same way that, you know, with the charge on an electron or something? You know what I mean? Like, it's not the same sort of thing. It could be different. It's just we doubt that it will be. And there's lots of things that in principle could change that would make that Halloween store not do a bunch of, you know, again, there could be a drought or something. There could be a flood the week before Halloween and they don't sell anything. You know, that's possible. Yeah. So I think we would handle it in that sort of fashion, that this use of Bayesian inference or whatever, these statistical models using AI and whatever, that's great. And to the extent that it's successful as judged by profitability means go ahead and use it, but just don't kid yourself that you're actually uncovering some deeper true theory of what drives human behavior. I think he would say something like that.
Gotcha. From the economic perspective. Gotcha. Right. Gotcha. There's also, I mean, there's a judgment call here. And again, I don't know if this is philosophical more than it's just judgment. But whereas, you know, if somebody's reading charts, I would say, hey, you know, there could be, you know, the economy goes through cycles and changes. If your chart's been good for the last 5 years, and you've been making money and you blew up the next year, that wouldn't surprise me at all. Whereas if I built a Bayesian model to detect images to see if there's a picture of Bob Murphy in it, and every time I showed it a matrix of pixels and said, yep, that's a picture of Bob Murphy, and no, this one isn't, and it was like 99% true when it was your picture and 1% when it wasn't, I'm not worried that that's going to like stop working, you know, after a certain period of year. Well, I guess you could change your look.
Well, I know this is probably like a standard thing that you learn on day two of the stuff you're in, but just in case, you know, some of your listeners, or if I rerun this on my show, but like my favorite thing with that is, I'm sure you've heard these, Max, the two examples of, they were showing the AI, you know, pictures of men versus women, and it thought it learned the difference. And then they showed it a picture of the Beatles and they thought they were women because they had long hair.
And yeah, then, yeah, and that then happens all the time.
With the military satellites, and they, you know, having they trained it on showing satellite photos and like of a forest, and in some pictures there were tanks like hidden underneath the trees, and so they trained it and told it, like, you know, they first, you know, with the training sessions identified, yep, these pictures all have hidden enemy units hiding in the trees, and then these ones don't; these are just clear forests, and the system learned. And then it went out with, you know, the new data, you know, out of sample test, and it did horribly. And they realized, oh shoot, the day that we, you know, where we took the photos with the tanks being hidden, it was a sunny day. And the day where there were no tanks, it was overcast. And so what the computer had learned was, oh, when it's sunny, you know, there's danger, and when it's overcast, it's fine. And that, of course, wasn't what they were trying to get it to learn. So even there with the Bob Murphy, you're right. Like, if, you know, suppose I get a tattoo or something and all of a sudden says, no, that's Tom Woods. Well, it wouldn't say it's Tom Woods. No, that's Dave Smith. Because it's learned that, you know, to not have a tattoo is something that's intrinsic to what the definition of Bob Murphy is.
Right, right.
So it might do very well up until the point when it doesn't. And then you could say, huh, how did it, you know, and like a normal man in the street would say, oh, see, it lacks common sense.
Yeah. Oh, although you could trick people too. It's just people and machines get tricked in very different ways. So, yeah. Well, that's what,
yeah,
I
yeah.
Would say.
I should be clear. I'm not, you know, I was really into, like, we were talking about the Gödel's theorems. I was all into the philosophy of mind stuff and, you know, Turing tests. And so, I'm not even there saying that's my. I'm just saying that's what the obvious rejoinder to what you said would be. That's all I'm.
Yeah. All right. I think I can wrap this up for today. This is a very good discussion. This is, I feel like in terms of podcast topics, this is at level hard, very hard, maybe, in my experience. But why not go for it? I had a great time, and I think that there was one thing that I wanted to say to close on this.
I think you want to urge everyone to buy my book.
What's your latest book? Or which book are you talking about? Are you talking about the study guide or the you have a new one?
I'm trying to think of which one do I make the most royalty off of to tell you. I mean, if somebody, and I'll joke it, so the study guide to human action, that's a free PDF they can get, you know, from the Mises. You could just Google Robert Murphy study guide to human action. You'll get that. My book Choice is not free, but I would say that that's, if somebody who's interested in the work of Ludwig von Mises, my book Choice is the one to get. If you want to see something more fun, then Contra Krugman's probably the one for you, where it's a collection of all my essays over the years pushing back against what I think are the very wrong columns of the Keynesian Paul Krugman.
Oh, that's so great. I'm like the second day of my undergrad economics course, and this was at Yale, they assigned a Krugman article, and I didn't, that was when I knew. I was like, I don't like this homework, I think was my first, I realized who he was. I think what I was going to say is one of the interesting things about this discussion is that, you know, there's what Mises said 80 years ago or 70 years ago now. There's, there's a lot of what you talk about in Austrian economics and the economics profession. And there's what I talk about to solve problems from an engineering perspective and sort of merging all of the, we all have different kind of terminology and language and sort of merging it and contending with it. The differences is tough, but I think that the amount of learning we'll get on the other side of this is going to be considerable. So I just want to close by saying that I know you wrote this study guide in 2008. You've written so many topics more recently. A few of the ones I want to point out are you've written a lot about healthcare and the healthcare system. You've written about Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, climate. There was one article you had which was about a world without prisons, how we could have a world without prisons, which I really thought was an amazing idea. And so I will link to all of that. And of course, Contra Krugman, which is one of my all-time favorite podcasts, your solo podcast at BobMurphyShow.com. Do you have any last thoughts on the discussion today? And is there anywhere else that we can find you?
On Twitter, I'm Bob Murphy Econ. I just appreciate this discussion. And yeah, at first when you told me what you want to talk about, I was thinking, wow, that's a really narrow topic. We'll be done in 12 minutes, but apparently not. I didn't even get around to answering your first question in 12 minutes.
Yeah. Well, I'm definitely going to continue this, this discussion on the show. And, maybe we can talk to each other at some point in the future. So thanks for coming on the show.
There's a good chance. See what I did there?
Yeah. Are you willing to put a number on it? Thanks for coming on the show.
Okay. Thanks for having me, Max.
All right. There are so many different threads that we pulled on in this conversation. I feel like it's going to lead to lots of more episodes from me, maybe even some blog posts if I ever get the discipline to do those again. I have one blog post that I'm kind of thinking about writing for a while, but it's sort of, okay, I talked at the beginning about how, there's controlled experiments are the most expensive. Bayesian inference, though, is still pretty expensive. So what can you do to make good decisions and form good beliefs short of that? And that's sort of one post I want to write. If you like this episode, a few others you should check out are episode 105 with mathematician Sophie Carr on her impression of Bayes' theorem, her take on Bayes' theorem. I mentioned episode 98 with Alex and Dora. He's also the host of the Learn Bayesian Statistics podcast. Definitely 78, which is my solo show on Bayesian thinking, and even more relevant, 21 and 22 on the interpretation of probability, and finally, way back to 0 and 1 on just an intro to Bayes' rule. I'll post these and more, plus all of Bob Murphy's links on the show notes at localmaxradio.com/107. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account, @MaxSklar. Have a great week. Feel the power.